Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, in the spectacular July 1st, 2007. We have a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about some of the breaking developments in media in the United States today, in policy in particular, concerning female minority ownership, concerning bias in radio, talk radio, and concerning the big battle over low-power FM radio taking place in Washington today. There have been striking developments in all these areas, and we're going to have two of the leading experts on these subjects, and they'll be equipped to talk about many more policy issues as well here on Media Matters. But first, before we do that, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The struggle to keep webcasting in business is moving in part to the courts. Ever since the Library of Congress's Copyright Royalty Board ruled earlier this year to impose draconian royalty rates on copyrighted content streamed online, webcasters have been living under the threat of fiscal death when those rates retroactively went into effect later this summer. An appeal to the CRB was dismissed. Now several groups with a stake in webcasting, including National Public Radio, Yahoo, America Online, and several independent streamers, have filed a motion in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to have the CRB's rate structure stayed indefinitely. This as momentum in Congress swings in favor of action toward the imposition of a revised, fairer royalty rate structure on webcasting. Currently, the Internet Radio Equality Act has more than 110 sponsors in the House of Representatives and three in the Senate. Sound Exchange, an entity that would oversee the collection of streaming royalty payments and is mostly funded by the major label record industry, senses that the political landscape is shifting on the issue and has since expressed a willingness to negotiate on an extension of the current rate structure, which Congress imposed on the industry following a similar crisis 5 years ago. At the same time, record labels have begun lobbying Congress to impose the same per-song, per-play royalty rate system for webcasting on broadcast radio, which for decades has enjoyed an exemption from recording royalties and instead pays a much lower yearly fee to music publishing companies directly. The Recording Industry Association of America sees an income stream from such a system amounting to hundreds of millions of dollars per year. The broadcast industry calls such a proposal a, quote, performance tax.
Quest, the number three phone company in the United States, is having a banner year. It ended last year with $600 million in profits and a share price that continues to rise. Who gets the credit for this positive performance? According to the company's board of directors, out of Quest's 38,000 employees, CEO Dick Notebaert is number one. That's why he made more than $30 million last year in salary, bonuses, stock options, and sales, and various perks. This does not include another $17 million in stock options that he received to boot. That makes Notebaert's compensation 1,600 times that of the average Quest worker. And of every $100 the company made last year, Notebaert took more than $4 for himself. Meanwhile, Quest has slashed the health care and retirement benefits of its current and former employees and faces a federal lawsuit for allegedly refusing to pay overtime to customer service workers. This may be why Mr. Notebaert announced he's getting out while the getting's good. Though he hasn't set an official resignation date, he says he'll be ready to leave once the company finds a qualified successor. No word yet on how opulent Notebaert's retirement package will be.
A class action lawsuit against the nation's major phone companies runs into a dead end in the U.S. Supreme Court. In a 7-2 decision, the court has dismissed a lawsuit alleging that customers were defrauded out of billions of dollars by the major phone companies, including AT&T, Verizon, and Quest, who colluded with each other in order to carve out service territories that each company could dominate and the rates they would charge for competing service. The Supreme Court said there wasn't enough evidence made available for the lawsuit to proceed. An attorney for consumers who pressed the case says it's disturbing that the High Court wouldn't even allow the suit to proceed into the discovery phase, where such evidence is most likely to be uncovered.
There's a suspicious alliance underway between the Knight Foundation, which is well known for giving grants to support new journalism projects, and Viacom, one of the largest media conglomerates in the world. The Knight Foundation just gave a $700,000 news challenge grant to Viacom-owned MTV to promote the use of cell phones as video cameras by teens during the 2008 presidential elections. The idea is that MTV viewers can record and report upon candidate stops where they live. The clips and reports will be hosted on MTV.com, and a select few will actually be aired on the network itself. However, this project does not disclose what data will be collected on cell phone users and whether behavior profiling techniques will be used on the data to target market to MTV's phone reporters. Such is the state of mainstream media that a not-for-profit group has to pay a wildly profitable media conglomerate to program such public interest initiatives, when the conglomerate itself makes more money every day than the entire Knight Foundation grant is worth.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, July 1st, 2007, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Truly beautiful and luxurious summer day here in the heartland. And we've got a great show for you today as well. Our guests today are two longtime media activists, two of the most significant players in the field today. They are both connected with the organization Free Press, and I think, as many of you know, that's a group that I'm on the board of and I've been connected to since its inception, so let's get that out in the open now. But these two gentlemen, Derek Turner and Joe Torres, have been very active in a number of the crucial issues taking place in Washington today, are singularly capable of discussing them. Derek Turner is the research director for Free Press. Before doing that, he earned a master's degree in public policy from the Goldman School at the University of California, Berkeley, where he won the 2006 Smolensky Prize for Outstanding Advanced Policy Analysis. Joe Torres is the government relations manager at Free Press, and he's worked closely on media policy and research in Washington for years. Before joining Free Press, Joe worked as a deputy director of communications and media policy at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and he was a working journalist for 8 years. Joe also is working on a book with Juan Gonzalez coming out next year. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that, too, if not now, in a later program. Derek and Joe, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Bob.
And that first voice was Joe, the second voice was Derek. Let's start with, there's a lot of ground I want to cover today, gentlemen. Let's start, if we can, with the big report that you primarily authored and worked on, Derek, concerning the state of radio ownership or broadcast ownership in the United States that came out just a few weeks ago. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. Well, as some of your listeners may remember, last fall we released a study on female minority ownership of television stations in the U.S., and we felt it was necessary to go ahead and get a complete picture and do the same type of study for radio stations, which number almost 12,000 across the country, and essentially, in theory, are a better entry point for women and minorities because they're much cheaper to purchase and to own and to operate. So we analyzed all 11,000-plus stations in the U.S. and found, surprisingly, that female minority ownership is terribly low. Women own about 6% of stations, and minorities own a little less than 8% of stations, which these numbers aren't very much higher than what we saw on television, which is really surprising given that they're about 10 times or more cheaper to own. We also looked at a bunch of other aspects of the radio industry and tried to determine what types of factors were keeping women and minorities out from owning these stations. And not surprisingly, overwhelmingly, the biggest factor was market concentration. The more concentrated markets become, the less likely you are to have female and minority-owned stations. And this is particularly because women and minorities are overwhelmingly local, single-station owners that have owned their stations for a while, and aren't interested in doing this nationally syndicated type big group owner business model. And as the concentration got worse after the 1996 Telecommunications Act, these owners were overwhelmingly just pushed out of the market and are unable to compete with these big guys.
So has the situation then deteriorated in the last 10 years? So are there fewer women and minority owners today than there were in 1996 or 1997?
We didn't do a longitudinal study just because of the difficulties of getting the old data. We do have some anecdotal evidence that that is the case, and we've talked to station owners and people who have been in the business all over the place, and overwhelmingly the feedback that we got was is that, look, you know, we've been pushed out. It's these big guys can come in and bid up the price of stations and bid up the price of content, and we just can't compete anymore. On the other end of it, we heard a lot from station owners that it's hard to get into the market nowadays, that you can't get into the market if you just want to buy one station. You have to buy six or seven stations in multiple markets, and you're sort of arm-twisted into what type of content you can air. You have to sign syndication deals, and you have very little control over your station. So the barrier to entry has just been raised to an insurmountable level for many women and minorities.
Joe Torres, some people say, well, this is not that big of a deal because, after all, the owners of radio stations are business people out to maximize profit, and that it's in their interest, therefore, to serve the public. So everyone in the community will be well taken care of by private owners in their pursuit of profit. Does that square with your experience?
It doesn't. You know, I just wish that was true. The very fact that, you know, we always hear the marketplace will take care of the community. It's just not true. You look at I'll give you an example outside of broadcast. Look at the Los Angeles Times. Here it is in the epicenter of the Latino culture in the United States is Los Angeles. Yet only under 6% of all of its staff members on the Los Angeles Times are Latino. And that paper has a history of neglecting the community. The Latino community has a very hostile relationship to the Los Angeles Times in historically in that city. And yet here's the Times about to be sold, the Tribune's about to sell the company. And a month leading up to that, you hear the incoming CEO of the Times coming in from Chicago discovering that there's a Latino community that needs to be covered now. If the marketplace was going to determine that the private ownership was going to be able to serve the Latino community, it would have done so decades ago. And yet, in 2007, they're still discovering that Los Angeles Times needs to cover the Latino community in Los Angeles. The same thoughts goes and applies to radio ownership and television station ownership. It is it's not a guarantee, but more likely the diversity of ownership and diversity of the president and CEO of that station, the greater chance you're going to have diversity of viewpoints on the airwaves.
Now, you've worked in a lot of newsrooms in your career, Joe, and so I assume you're basing this on personal experience to a certain extent.
Yeah, you know, and also working for the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, I mean, you've just seen examples after examples of journalists who are in the newsroom who make a difference, who fought behind the scenes to make sure the voices of the community are heard despite barriers and challenges. I mean, I can tell you so many examples, firsthand account of where a Latino journalist has made a difference, or a journalist of color, or a woman journalist. Just the diversity of viewpoint. It's not a guarantee that person, because they're a person of color, is going to actually be in a newsroom and actually advocate for communities of color. But the greater the numbers, the greater the chances that that's actually going to happen.
You've just been listening to Joe Torres, Government Relations Manager for Free Press. We're also on the line with us from Washington is Derek Turner, Research Director for Free Press. We're talking about minority and women ownership of broadcast media. We're talking about the new study that shows the strong, strident right-wing bias to talk radio in the United States, and also some exciting news about the low-power FM bill before Congress that has a chance to dramatically transform and enhance the low-power FM radio sector in the United States that Joe Torres has been working on aggressively this year. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Derek Turner and Joe Torres, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And I must say, these are true renaissance men of media forum. There's no issue they can't discuss if you're interested in media policy or media politics in the United States. So do call in if you wish. Derek, back to you if I can for a second. Since you authored the study, for the most part, of the radio study, which has received, I think, critical acclaim from people who've looked at it, what has been the response you've gotten from different communities, from commissioners at the FCC, who I know are aware of it, from people on Capitol Hill? Is this getting attention? Is it going to have impact? And what's been the response of people in industry to the extent you know?
Well, you know, this study and the television study have generated a lot of impact, and I think it's really pushed the issue of female minority ownership back to the forefront. You know, the FCC actually has a diversity committee that's supposed to be sort of studying these issues, and prior to our reports last fall, this diversity committee essentially just languished, and their funding dried up, and there was no meeting scheduled or anything like that. And shortly after our first study came out, they were given more funding and given a schedule and you know, given you know, a chance to meet again and to discuss some of these issues. Even the Republican commissioners at the FCC have now started talking about this issue in a more prominent way since some of these studies have come out. And we've gotten a lot of positive feedback from Capitol Hill from both sides of the aisle. This is generally an issue, you know, no one is against women and minorities being adequately represented on the public airwaves, at least not verbally, out in the open. So it's something that people want to understand the problem. Now, there's a different approach on how to actually go about solving the problem, and that's where I think, from a long-term perspective, organizations like Free Press are going to have to keep beating down these congressmen's doors and these commissioners' doors and really try to let them know and make them understand that this isn't some sort of natural outcome of the marketplace, that this is a direct result of bad policy decisions made at the Congress and made at the Commission over the past 10 years.
Joe Torres, right now the Federal Communications Commission is in the process of holding public hearings around the country. One was just held last Thursday in Portland, Maine, getting public input on how it should consider revising media ownership rules. These hearings initially are these deliberations on revising and relaxing media ownership rules the SEC has been conducting. The last great wave of these took place in 2003, and as many of our listeners know, it was that set of reviews, hearings the SEC held and their deliberations on media ownership rules that triggered the great media reform movement in the United States today. Is it possible for the FCC to get away with revising or relaxing its media ownership rules and ignore the state of women and minority ownership of radio and television, do you think?
Well, you know, they actually, it's a great question because when I was at NHJ just a few months ago, last year in April 2006, our association actually wrote a letter to the NTIA, the National Telecommunications and Information Agency, who had been, since 1990, conducting a biannual survey on the state of minority ownership. The last study that agency actually put out was in December of 2000. So here it is, December of 2000 to 2006. There wasn't any kind of surveying or any kind of study or examination from any federal agency, whether the NTIA or the FCC, on the state of minority ownership. We got a response to that letter from the NTIA when I was at NHJ saying that they had no plans to do it. This is where Free Press came in. Free Press came in and actually saw the response, and Derek and Ben Scott, the policy director, went ahead and conducted these studies. And because of these studies, the first was the television study, and then the second, the radio study a few weeks ago, you had senators speaking out against it. The Congressional Hispanic Caucus saying to the FCC, how come there hasn't been an examination the FCC hasn't paid attention to the issue of minority ownership? The court, the federal court in the Prometheus versus the FCC in 2004, when those ownership rules were remanded from 2003, actually addressed this, said that the FCC has not been paying attention to the issue of minority ownership. Now, it's only now that the FCC has decided, recently, several months ago, announced it's going to conduct several studies that included the issue of minority ownership. So there was an excellent chance that this issue wasn't going to receive even an examination of a study being conducted to examine the impact on consolidation on minority owners and people of color. But it took these studies, I believe, and the amount of attention it received, and it continued to receive at these hearings from individuals bringing it up, from the commissioners, Adelstein and Cox bringing it up, for the FCC to begin, I think, for the first time in a long time, to actually begin to even examine these issues.
Hey, Bob, can I jump in here real quick?
Please do, Derek Turner.
So I think one of the things that your listeners should be aware of is that when Chairman Powell tried this last time, it was ultimately struck down by a court on a legal basis, basically saying that the FCC acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner. That's sort of the legal standard here.
When the FCC tried to greatly relax media ownership rules so the biggest companies could buy up a lot more media.
Exactly, last time in 2003, and then that was struck down. So the current chairman, a different chairman, Kevin Martin, is really walking a fine line here. He probably wants to do some of the same things that Powell did, but he knows that he's under a microscope, and he knows that there's this court remand. And so the issue of minority ownership is actually was a prominent part of the court decision. So I think what's going to happen here is that they have actually ordered 10 official studies, the FTC has, that should be coming out. They're actually a little late. They should be coming out soon. And I think what they're going to try to do in those studies, we have some inside information that they sort of tried to shop around and find researchers that would give them their conclusions ahead of time. And I think what they're going to try to do with that study is sort of muddy the water and basically come out with the conclusion, well, you know, there's no real direct link maybe between concentration and the level of female minority ownership, and so maybe if we loosen the rules a little bit, it won't really hurt the situation. There's other policies that may actually help that FTC has no ability to control. This is a congressional issue. So I think they're going, if they do try to actually do anything, they'll sort of try to do it under the guise of these so-called academic studies that they've commissioned. But ultimately, I think with the changeover in Congress, Martin's even more scared to really do anything quite overt. So it may be that nothing actually happens at the commission, and they just hold these hearings and then actually don't make any rule changes.
And Bob, if I could add one more thing to
this. Please do, Joe.
That, you know, the fact that when FIPRES looked at these studies, and they were looking at the NTIA reports, after the NTIA wrote back NHJ, the first thing they found was that the data was inaccurate. That the FCC was, they looked at the FCC ownership data, and the data was inaccurate. So here's the FCC collecting data on the female ethnic and racial makeup of each license holder in this country, and the information that they possess, they weren't even quality controlling it. So this is an example of the historical neglect the FCC has paid to the issue of minority ownership.
Indeed. Our guest today, Joe Torres, Government Relations Manager at Free Press, who you just heard, and before him, our other guest, Derek Turner, Research Director at Free Press. We're talking about the state of female minority ownership of U.S. media. We're about to talk about the new Free Press Center for American Progress research study indicating there's an extraordinary far-right bias to talk radio in the United States, and also the low-power FM bill, which is going through Congress now. It's a very important bill, not getting a great deal of attention, that Joe Torres has been centrally involved in working on. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments on any of these subjects or anything else concerning media policy or journalism, the number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number at WILL AM580 is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Farina, welcome to the airwaves.
Hi. Thanks for another interesting show. I just happened to see a little bit of Fox Sunday on television this morning with Mark Green. I think he's the CEO of Air America. They were talking about the fairness doctrine when I tuned in, and I didn't really catch what they were saying except that he was for it or reinstating it or something like that. One thing I did pick up on was he had a remedy for the monopoly ownership of more local input for station license renewal to have hearings in the communities where licenses are renewed. I thought that sounded good. Also, could you mention what's new with the song fees for the internet radio, and also who appoints the FCC commissioners? That's all I have to ask today. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. That's a good assignment for the rest of the show. Well, maybe if we could start with Derek, you could just talk a little bit about the FCC commissioners, and then we could go to the internet radio, and then take it from there.
Right, yeah. The first stuff he talked about, we'll probably get into when we talk more about the Center for American Progress study.
That's right.
Yeah, so the FCC is a five-member body that is appointed by the president, the current executive, and he is allowed to appoint three members from his own party and two members from the opposite party. So right now the makeup is three Republicans. You have the chairman, Kevin Martin, Robert McDowell, and Deborah Tate. And then the Democrats are Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein. They serve essentially at the pleasure of the president, but their terms are five-year terms, and usually, unless they do anything egregious, they're usually reappointed. So the most recent commissioner that was reappointed was Deborah Tate.
Okay, and now about internet radio. I think this is an issue we spoke about. We had Davey D on the air about 6 or 7 weeks ago, maybe a little longer. Time flies. And we were talking about the threat to internet radio. Media Minutes today talked about it again at the top of the hour of this broadcast. What is the status of internet radio now? I know Free Press has been working on this issue.
Right. Well, so the, I mean, your viewers or your listeners probably know a lot more about this than I do. It's not an issue that I work on exclusively, but the basic gist of it is that unlike over-the-air radio, where the record companies have essentially worked out a deal with the broadcasters that there is essentially no royalty transfers, anything like that, that everything's aired for free, internet radio was never subject to that. So there's a board that's sort of been trying to establish what the royalty rates and payment rules will be. And the way they essentially structured it was a ridiculous structure that would essentially put most medium and small size internet broadcasters out of the business, which is really a tragedy. Since, you know, if you turn on your local broadcast radio, you're mostly going to hear the same 10 song playlist on an adult contemporary station or on a rock station. But on the internet, you're more likely to get exposed to a lot of different and diverse content. And we're never saying that these artists shouldn't be reimbursed, but it should be somewhat proportional to not killing the medium. So there were some appeals of that rate decision, but essentially right now it sort of stands at a stalemate. A lot of internet radio broadcasters last week had a day of silence where they stopped broadcasting for 24 hours to try to raise awareness on the issue.
Joe Torres, one of the things the caller mentioned as a remedy that he had heard is the idea that there be local hearings for station license renewal so people in the community can give their direct input on whether the station is serving the community. What do you think of that idea?
Well, it's a great idea. I mean, the first thing that I think needs to change is then this how stations are the license renewal process is just is almost impossible, nearly impossible to actually challenge a station license. I mean, it used to be you can challenge a station license. A station went up for renewal every 3 years. I believe it's every 8 years now, and it's pretty much kind of sealed with just the station just to send in some sort of postcard to get a renewal. The laws were changed actually because of in the late 60s and 70s, there was a lot of groups challenging licenses after that WLPT case, which the court actually ruled that U.S. citizens had standing before the SEC to challenge your license. And once they started to challenge the license, all the different citizens groups, the FCC changed the law. And so now it makes it real hard for the public to actually have any sort of input into challenging their license. And I know Commissioner Cox has talked a lot about that has to change. Hopefully, with a different type of FCC, that's something that potentially can get addressed one day.
Our guests, Derek Turner and Joe Torres, you just heard, both work with Free Press out of Washington, D.C. on a number of media policy issues we'll be talking about today. Let's go back to the phone lines right now if we can. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yeah, what is the status of net neutrality?
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like a question that gets right to the point. There we are. Derek and Joe, maybe one of you could give just a brief background on what net neutrality is for those listeners who might not be familiar with the term.
Okay, I'll take a stab at this. This is sort of a different issue. We're not really talking about broadcast anymore. We're talking about the Internet. But net neutrality is basically the principle of non-discrimination on the Internet, that a network operator, the person that owns the network running into your house, so either your DSL line or your cable line, that company cannot dictate who gets to flow over those wires into your home. This has been a bedrock principle of communication since the founding of telecommunications.
I mean, all websites are created equal, basically.
All websites are created equal. If you want to start a business on the Internet and you want to reach people, your business can reach them, you know, essentially in the same manner that any other large business can. Now, you have to pay to get onto the Internet like anyone else does. You have to pay for your data fees and stuff to get onto the Internet. But once you do that, your traffic cannot be discriminated. And that's essentially a bedrock principle of telecommunications that has been around since the start. Slowly, the FCC started dismantling that with regards to the Internet. And this is a process that sort of began back in 2002 and then sort of came to a head in 2005. There were some waivers and other type things and merger conditions that sort of have kind of put the game on hold. But ultimately, this is something that either the FCC is going to have to establish a principle of non-discrimination or either Congress is going to have to come in and step in. So right now we're sort of in a holding pattern because of AT&T and the Bell South merger. There was a they agree to for a period of time to not engage in any shenanigans and do any kind of discrimination. And that's sort of disciplining the rest of the industry to sort of wait and see what happens. Right now, the FCC itself is engaged in what's called a notice of inquiry proceeding, where they invite public comment on the issue of net neutrality. And so if you go to SaveTheInternet.com, actually until July 16th, you can actually tell your story to the FCC and tell them how you know, the Internet affects your life and how net neutrality matters to you. After that proceeding closes, it's unlikely the FCC will really do anything in the near future. So this is essentially an issue that we're going to have to push back into the Congress. Last session, when the Congress was under the hands of the Republicans, in the relevant committee in the Senate, the Commerce Committee, there was a net neutrality amendment that essentially came to a draw, an 11-11 tie, essentially along party lines. Now the Congress is a little bit more favorable, but I think they're sort of being a little cautious with what kind of legislation they take on, and they're sort of going a little slow. But so it's no time to let down your guard, and it's definitely time for people to keep the pressure on and get their representatives to come out and take a stand for net neutrality.
Joe Torres, the way Derek just described net neutrality was very good, but to someone who's never heard of it before, it might sound like something that's primarily of importance to people wanting to start websites or start their own businesses to compete with the Amazons and the Googles and the Yahoos. Is net neutrality an issue that affects average, everyday people? Is it an issue that you can organize around?
I personally absolutely think so. A lot of these media ownership issues and telecom issues, once you kind of explain it in a language that people can easily understand, they get it, and they get very upset by it. That neutrality, I think, is definitely one of them. I mean, just think about it. Think if you have your own, let's say, I always give this example to Latino and African-American groups I'm talking to. Let's say if you have a black-owned newspaper, or say a Spanish-language newspaper, and you want to compete in your local community. But yeah, here's the Washington Post, let's say in the D.C. area, they own a Spanish-language paper, El Tiempo Latino, and it's known that neutrality principles guiding us. Well, the Washington Post most likely can actually pay to make sure that El Tiempo Latino is seen at the fastest speeds. But if you have the other the other Spanish-language paper in this area who's owned by an individual, there's a greater chance they're not going to have the resources to actually make sure that their site is seen the fastest. And the more folk, the more households that have broadband access, they're not going to visit the site that the site that's going to be degraded in speed. They're going to go to the site that delivers the content to them the fastest, and that's going to change the economic model of the internet. I mean, more and more people. I mean, those companies that can afford to pay will see greater advertising dollars go their way, and the same kind of model, the same kind of issues we find here on just the. On broadcast ownership, is the same kind of barriers that are going to be extended to the internet. I believe folks who may be able to compete today in a chance to compete at least will find that the barriers to entry, the barriers to actually compete economically, is going to be that much more difficult.
This is such an important issue. We're going to have to turn to another entire program, to network neutrality, in the coming months. But I think I want to move on now, if we can, to another study that Free Press has released, this time a joint study with the Center for American Progress on the state of talk radio and the political coverage of talk radio in the United States today. And Derek, could you talk a little bit about explaining what that study was and what you found? But before you do, would you please identify the Center for American Progress for folks who might not be familiar with that organization?
Sure. The Center for American Progress is a D.C.-based think tank. Some of your more savvy listeners may have visited their blog called thinkprogress.org. They are a nonpartisan research and educational institute sort of dedicated to promoting a strong and just and free America that ensures opportunities for all. They work on a number of different issues, and media is just a small thing. They work on the war. They work on social policy. They work on all kinds of issues, but essentially they are a progressive nonpartisan organization that are basically doing a lot of the important policy research that needs to be done in D.C.
And so tell me, if you would, a little bit about the study that you conducted with the center.
Right. So I think the point of doing the study was to set out to show what we already know, that the sky is blue, that talk radio dial is overwhelmingly right wing, and it's initially just an attempt to actually quantify exactly how that is. So the first part of the study was primarily written by Center for American Progress, and they essentially looked at all the stations owned by the five biggest station group owners in the U.S., and they also looked at all the stations in the top 10 markets and tried to see what the breakdown was between conservative and progressive talk show programming. And among the big guys, the big five guys who own a ton of stations, these are your Clear Channels and your CBSs and your Salems and Citadel companies, that it was essentially a 9-to-1 breakdown. So 91% of their total weekday talk radio programming was conservative versus just 9% progressive. And when they actually looked at certain markets, it was really astonishing. Places like Philadelphia, which is a very liberal and somewhat progressive city, has absolutely no progressive talk show programming at all. It's 100% conservative. And so then the report essentially tried to, after we proved that the sky was blue, that we proved what we already knew, to try to actually look at why it was the way it was. And we tried to debunk some of the common arguments you hear for this. The most prominent one is that, well, this is just what the market demands, that progressives just can't do well on the radio dial, and it's 90% conservative because that's what the market demands. And that's essentially just a very bogus argument, because if you actually look at the breakdown of even listeners that listen to talk radio, they do skew slightly conservative, but there's only about 45% of the listeners to talk radio actually identify themselves as conservative. Overwhelmingly, plurality is identify themselves as progressive or moderate. So it certainly, that does not explain it. And what we actually found was that there seems to be a strange trend in the industry as it becomes more concentrated and consolidated, that station owners are sort of forced to take on syndicated programming. And if they subscribe to a certain program, like let's say they want to air Rush because he's the most popular talk show host, that these syndicators often say, okay, well, if you take Rush, you're going to also have to take Glenn Beck. You're also going to have to take Drudge, and you're going to have to air those shows as well. So it was ultimately the economics of the radio industry had more to do with it than it did the actual market demand.
Joe Torres, this is an issue, too. What are the implications from your experience as a journalist going in city after city in the United States if the sort of political dialogue on the radio, which is sort of the blue-collar, working-class, everyday American medium, is dominated by one particular viewpoint?
Well, I see it a little differently, too. I totally agree that it definitely limits the diversity of viewpoints. But I think, unfortunately, folks tie all this into real journalism. They think these talking heads actually represent real journalism and the actual everyday journalist who wants to get it right gets lumped into this sphere of talk radio and cable talk shows, and people lump it all together, and I think it hurts the credibility of journalism overall, because unfortunately these folks are they get journalists who are too often that they're not. I don't really consider them journalists. They are folks who are just pushing a point of view that they're getting highly paid to do again on these shows, and people are, the lines of journalism are being blurred more and more, I think.
Derek Turner, one of the points that an earlier caller made was that maybe the fairness doctrine is the solution here. And oftentimes when people talk about the nature of talk radio and American radio, they say, hey, well, why don't we have the fairness doctrine so stations have to air different viewpoints, not just one particular viewpoint? What do you think of that as the solution to this problem?
Okay, well, Bob, this is going to be maybe somewhat controversial with some of your listeners, but in the CAP report, we actually did take a look at the fairness doctrine and tried to see if the repeal of the fairness doctrine was the primary cause of the rise in right-wing radio.
And, again, for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the term fairness doctrine, could you just give a brief definition or description of it?
Sure. The fairness doctrine is a part of the set of regulations that govern the broadcast radio and television sphere. The Fairness Doctrine itself basically said that broadcasters had an obligation to cover controversial issues, and if they covered the controversial issues, they were obliged to do it in a sort of even-handed fashion. There's other similar doctrines that are actually still on the books, like the Equal Time Rule. If you do a non-news broadcast show about a candidate running for office, that you have to give equal time to his opponent. Things like that are still on the books. In 1987, the FCC basically decided that it was no longer going to enforce the Fairness Doctrine. 2 years later, there was a court case that said, okay, the FCC doesn't have to enforce it, but technically the law is still on the books, so if they actually wanted to decide to enforce it, they could. But anyway, getting back to the study, when we actually looked at it, essentially the egg has already been fried. And to unfry the egg would be a very difficult thing. If we did reinstate the fairness doctrine, we'd run up against a very difficult issue of trying to control speech on the radio. And I don't think that it would, in practicality, be something that could easily be enforced and be something that could actually work. What we actually found was is that if you want to turn the tide and you want to increase the diversity of types of voices on the radio, the best way to do that is not to sort of regulate what type of content is on the radio, but is to diversify ownership. And some of the results of the study point to this. We overwhelmingly found that local owners, smaller owners, that is, they own fewer stations, women owners, minority owners, were all less likely to air conservative programming, just highly less likely to air these conservative talk show programming. Minorities were more likely to air progressive programming. Local owners were more likely to have a diverse set of programming. If you had minorities and women in a market, you were more likely to have both progressive and both conservative talk show programming. So ultimately, we think the answer to this is not less speech, but more speech and more local speech in the hands of local owners. And that's something that I think your listeners should really hone in on, is that broadcast itself is a local medium. It's not something that you put up a radio tower and it broadcasts all across the country. It's not like satellite radio. It only broadcasts to local areas. So your listeners are listening to this in Champaign County and probably not much further beyond, because the signal doesn't spread that. So what those people want to hear is not national content that they can get anywhere else. What they want to hear is local content. And so ultimately, we think the rules need to be reinstated to drive local ownership, to give people local content again. And if you do that, I think you're going to diversify what types of content you hear on the radio. You're going to change the economics of the radio industry to where it's not just overwhelmingly cheap to air Rush Limbaugh, that it's more profitable actually to air local content and have local talk shows and local hosts on, like your show.
Our guest. Oh, good. Joe Torres, go ahead.
If I can add what Derek just said, you know, his study he put out on the radio ownership, it showed that women were by far more likely to be locally to own stations in the communities they live in, to be locally owned stations. Minorities, people of color, in larger markets where the majority of minority ownership stations reside, they're far more likely to be locally owned than not. So it goes to the very issue, the structural issues, that the more diversity the airways, the more minority owners, women owners, the more likely they're going to be locally owned stations.
Our guest, Joe Torres, Government Relations Manager for Free Press, who you just heard. Before him, you heard Derek Turner, the Research Director for Free Press. We're talking about media ownership, bias in commercial broadcasting, and also what we're going to talk about in a second, the low-power FM radio bill coming before Congress. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Joe Torres and Derek Turner, the number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You're listening to WILL, AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. My name is Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Let's turn now, if we can, Joe Torres, to the low-power FM situation. Some of our listeners are familiar with it because we do have a low-power FM station right here in Urbana, Illinois. But many listeners, and you'll be interested to know, Derek Turner, over half the listeners to our program now come via computer, via podcasting, so they're not from this area, may not be familiar with low-power FM radio. Could you, Joe, just give a description of what low-power FM radio is, and then talk about where it stands today.
Well, yeah, low-power FM radio is these 100-watt stations that are licensed to community groups that broadcast in a radius of 3 to 5 miles. And basically what happened is in 2000, Chairman Kennard and the FCC was able to pass a rulemaking procedure that would license these low power FM stations. Again, they had to be licensed to a group that is based in the community, not to an individual or not to a corporation. But Congress in 2000 got a lot of a blowback from the NAB, National Association of Broadcasters. And so what happened, Congress passed a regulation, the Radio Preservation Act of 2000, that actually limited the number of LPFM stations on the air. Stations had to be distanced. A low-power station LPFMs have to be located at a certain space away from a full-power station, so not to cause interference. With the FCC passed in 2000, it would have brought stations, LPF stations, be able to be licensed closer, a little closer to the full-power stations. The NAB was able to successfully push Congress to push it further away from these to be licensed at the near the full power stations. they were claiming interference, the NAB. But what happened is that when Congress passed the Radio Preservation Act of 2000, they asked the FCC to study the issue whether it was actually interference that that the FCC plan was calling for. And they found out in 2003, the FCC released a study that found out there was no significant interference at all with the FCC's plans at licensing stations little closer to the full power station. And so nothing happened since then, though. There's a $2 million study that debunked the NAB claims in 2000, but nothing has happened. And so what has happened now is that there's a 2 weeks ago, there was a bipartisan bill introduced from Congressman Doyle and Congressman Terry in the House and Senator McCain and Cantwell in the Senate to license LPFM stations to the original intent of the FCC in 2000. Now, what has happened since then, though, since 2000, LPFM stations are, like I mentioned, are a license further away than they have to be from a full-power commercial station. But 800 stations have been licensed since 2000, and they are located in more rural areas. And these stations are run by a cross-section of America. They're run by church groups, civil rights groups, immigrant groups. And so this has become, we believe, a bipartisan issue because there are Republicans who have low-power stations in a district run by church groups that represent the same, I would imagine, similar political ideology. There are immigrant groups that are represented by that run low-power stations. So this is an issue that really benefits and strengthens communities, and I believe that Republican and Democrats really understand that this is an issue that really benefits their community, their constituents, and so we really hope that this is the year we can actually get this bill passed, and there may be thousands of more LPFM stations airing across the country as a result.
When do you think this will come to the floor, if it does, Joe Torres, for a vote by Congress?
Well, the Senate is going to vote. We hear the Senate is going to mark this up in July. And we're working on the House side. Right now we're working on getting co-sponsors in the House. And so Free Press has sent down action alerts to its members to call their local congressmen and ask them to support H.R. 2802, the low-power FM bill, Doyle and Terry, Lee Terry's bill. And so we hope that something soon in the House, but in the Senate, we hear it's going to be July.
And Joe Torres, if folks want to learn more about this LPFM bill or the issue in general, where would you send them on the Internet?
Yeah, definitely go to our website, freepress.net. On the left-hand side of the navigation tube, you're going to find a link to community radio and local radio now is called, I believe. And you click on that, and it'll tell you all about this issue.
Okay, our guests, Joe Torres and Derek Turner from Free Press. The phone number here at Media Matters at WILL-AM580, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, San Francisco, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to call to make some very personal comments, hopefully to spur some thought. You all mentioned talk radio is predominantly right-wing today, but I'm worried that radio is becoming predominantly talk radio. Whatever happened to classical music stations on the radio? I just read that there are only about 28 classical stations in the U.S. today. San Francisco, where I live, has only one, KDFC, and it's mostly canned classical in a city that's very rich in all types of diverse programming. I'm afraid the loss of classical stations spurs satellite radio sales to the exclusion of regular radio and sales to an elite audience, and it also makes the U.S. less competitive with other countries because other countries are able to stream diverse programs. And one last personal note, I noticed this week the syndicated program Carl Hass ended its 24-year run because they simply do not have enough stations to carry it. Just my comments. Thank you for the program.
Thank you very much. Derek Turner, local ownership, is that related to the demise of classical music, or is there something else going on there?
Well, I think it directly is. There's a couple things going on. First, these formats like classical that used to be a lot more prominent are getting pushed off the dial, not because there's a lack of demand for it or there's a lack of listenership for it. It's primarily because of media consolidation. You have a company like Clear Channel, who owns over 1,000 stations, whereas 10 years ago they only owned 40, it's much easier for them to use their own syndication arm and pump in their own content to all their stations across the country than it is for them to actually do some kind of local programming, hire local DJs to air the type of programming that are demanded in local areas. They'll lose some listeners by doing this, but overall it's a much cheaper operation for them. So the economics have completely changed to where it's this big national blah sort of formatting, whereas you're not getting any type of the formatting that your listener described. I think the other aspect is this is sort of why it's very important to support nonprofit media, to support public media. One of the ways is by these bills that Joe were talking about. These low-power FM are, by definition, non-commercial stations that are local. And if there's a significant demand for something like a local classical music or classical music that's not sort of canned classical music like your listener described, then these community groups are in a great position to air that. And the other side of that is your traditional sort of non-commercial public radio stations that are operated, that are listener-supported. These type of stations are overwhelmingly more likely to air classical music and to air the type of classical music that their listeners want to hear. We've done a good job with this current Congress of maintaining funding for public broadcasting, but essentially we have to do this every year, and we're sort of getting by on a piecemeal approach here. I think we need to start thinking about long-term solutions for public broadcasting, which dramatically increase their funding and give them a sort of long-term stable source of funding where they don't have to come back with their hand out every year to Congress and bring out Big Bird and Clifford the Red Dog and do these publicity events to make sure that their funding is continued. We need to start recognizing how important non-commercial media is in our lives and doing a lot more to support it.
Joe Torres, you are a working journalist. You come from the world of journalism. You worked at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists for many years. Coming from the world of journalism, moving into media policy activism, as you have now with your job at Free Press, what is the, if you can generalize from your dealings with journalists over the years, your colleagues, what is the sort of mood of journalists today toward what's going on in the media world, the media system, with the state of the news?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think journalists, more and more of them, are very fearful about their future. This is very much not a profession, particularly the folks who are more veteran journalists. This is not the profession they got into, and this is not the kind of journalism that they got into to actually practice. Journalists, when I first started dealing with this issue back in 2002, when Juan Gonzalez became NEC president and really made this a top priority for the organization, a lot of journalists, even though they work in the industry, they really don't understand media policy. they don't follow it. And even though they are directly impacted, perhaps more so than any other working professionals, but now by 5 years later, there's a drastic mood change in the newsroom. They're much more conscious now of who, particularly in newspapers, at who owns them. I mean, I can't tell you now when I go to journalism conventions how many more journalists. Just a couple of weeks ago, Ben Scott and I were at the NHJ Hispanic Journalist Convention, and we got an award, and we actually made a speech about media consolidation and all this. About 10 journalists came up to us afterwards telling us the state of their newsroom, how these are mainstream journalists, how they are just dismayed by what's going on, and how the owners don't care about journalism. And this is a sea change than where we were just 5 years ago. So there's greater consciousness of this issue more so than ever before, and I think they don't know as journalists. And I also know of journalists who wanted to cover this issue, but were told they cannot cover this issue because it goes against the intent of their owner. The owner actually wants to purchase TV stations. These were newspaper journalists who wanted to cover this issue, told they couldn't. So. I think they don't know I think they feel a sense of helplessness because they don't know what the solution is to this. They don't know it because newspapers, for the most part, are not those doesn't come under any sort of regulation. I think they feel a sense of powerlessness, and it's really, really unfortunate because we need journalists, and particularly we need newspaper journalists.
Derek Turner, you do the research for Free Press. You're one of the leading researchers on media policy issues in Washington. And, one of the things that's striking to me when I read your research studies and I see it is that I would have hoped there'd be a lot more academics, since there are so many communication scholars in the United States. I'm one of them, and there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them gainfully employed doing research on communication issues. What's going on? Why are we not seeing more academics participating in doing policy research like you're doing?
Well, I mean, let me first state that the academics out there in the communications field are doing really wonderful work, but a lot of it is, as you say, it's not necessarily directly relevant to what we're working on at any given time. It's sort of this notion of basic research that builds knowledge upon knowledge, and that's extremely useful. But there is a strong need and an overwhelming need, especially in the public interest community, for quality research products that really can help influence and change minds. I think a lot of academics are sort of by nature a little bit scared to get involved in the policy process because there is obviously a very political dimension to it, and they don't want to see that their work is politicized. I personally believe that if your work is strong and stands on its own merits, that it can withstand any kind of politicization and it sort of speaks for itself. But over time, and I think the National Conference for Media Reform has helped to sort of change this a little bit and raise the awareness of the issue, I think over time you are seeing some academics that are getting involved and doing things that are directly relevant to the policy process. Ben Scott and I are working with some academics, of course, with you guys and then some people at Penn State to sort of try to plug them into the process a little bit more, get them involved early on and tell them what types of bills will be coming up and what the issues are and sort of help start directing and planning what types of things they should be looking into. But, of course, giving them the academic freedom that they always should have and enjoy. As time progresses, I think this will change somewhat. And I also think from the other side of it, from the policy side, not a lot of policy scholars are really aware of the issue of media policy, and I think we've helped raise that issue a little bit, and you start to see younger people coming through grad school who know that this is now an issue that they can work on, and it's actually an issue they're very passionate about, and it's a good issue for them to work on because there's not a lot of other people there working on the issue, so it's definitely a ripe field for them to take on.
Derek Turner and Joe Torres, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I'd like to give each of you about a minute, if I can, just to basically lay out for our listeners here what you think the big issues of the next year or two in media are going to be that people should be paying attention to. Derek, why don't you go first?
Well, I definitely think that all the telecommunications issues that we're working on that have to do with the Internet are extremely important, and Joe alluded to this a little bit earlier, but with broadcast and with print, the public were essentially left behind before the game started. With the Internet, we have a seat at the table right at the very beginning. And it's more of a level playing field than the public has ever gotten. And so that's why it's extremely, extremely important to not let these telecom and cable companies who control your access to the Internet to come in and control what type of content flows over that Internet and to completely shut off an avenue for citizen journalism. So the issues of net neutrality and the issues of bringing affordable Internet and competitive Internet offerings to millions of Americans who don't have that right now, that's going to be one of the most important issues. Secondary to that is all the issues of media ownership, which I think are now sort of becoming more entwined with the issues of the Internet because broadcasters themselves now are sort of moving their content on the Internet. Newspapers are moving their content on the Internet. So it's all one big issue, and I think that's primarily where our focus is going to be over the next couple of years.
Joe?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think network neutrality for me is like the most important issue. I mean, Bob, you've written about this so much. To me, the network neutrality debate it mirrors exactly the radio debate back at the turn of the century until the Federal Radio Commission came in and started regulating radio for the first time. I still think there's a lot of educating to do with the public on the issue of network neutrality. The average person believes, like the internet, that you cannot regulate it. That it provides all this freedom of expression that you cannot stop. But that's the same argument he made with radio. They say radio is going to provide the average person with a voice. It's going to bring greater democracy. It was going to bring people closer together, families, individuals. What happened with radio and what happened is what's happening to the Internet to me is so similar. The fact is that here it is. The government helped to create radio, helped to develop radio, and the government helped to develop the Internet. And here we're going to turn it over into private hands, and they're going to have private companies determining who basically can, I personally think, who can speak at the, who can be heard with the loudest microphone. And I think that is, to me, the most important issue we're fighting right now.
Joe Torres, Derek Turner, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank both of you for being our guests today on Media Matters. Good luck with your work. We'll be staying in touch.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, as always, for being my producer, doing a terrific job. My name is Bob McChesney. I will be back 1 week from today with Matt Rothschild discussing his new book. Until then, have a great summer week. See you then. Take care.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the lower 80s and northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the upper 50s and northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny with a high in the lower 80s and light southeast winds. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International, in the nation's capital, I'm Tavis Smiley. For the first time in the history of our nation, the race for the Oval Office will reflect some of the diversity in America. But is it more symbolism than substance? Today, the All-American Presidential Forum.
Well, I really believe that it takes a village to raise a child, and the American village has failed our children.
The starting place is to understand that there is no one single cause of poverty.
When you've got a bill called No Child Left Behind, you can't leave the money behind for No Child Left Behind.
On this special program, we hear from all the Democratic candidates, Senator Hillary Clinton, Senator Joe Biden, Governor Bill Richardson, Senator John Edwards, Senator Barack Obama, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel, and Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd. It's the All-American Presidential Forum from PBS on the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI after the news.